Well, good morning, church. Thank you. Thank you for that, Tommy. Oh, I was tempted to just stay there and be still for a little bit longer. It was moving. I appreciate that song. Oh, it's good to be with you this morning. I hope that your time with us this morning has been a blessing to you. If you're visiting with us this morning, we especially want you to know how glad we are of your presence and let you know that you're always welcome to come back and join us anytime we get together or anytime we're not together. You can just come to our homes. We don't care. Anyway, it's good to be together with you. I had some great reports from the last or the first round of our small group meetings. How many of you, by the way, are in small groups that either have met or are planning on meeting? How many of you are in small groups? Just raise your hands. That's almost, I'd say that's probably a majority. It's certainly all the cool kids. And so, no, we're glad. We're glad and good to hear the good things that are coming out of. See, if you're, those of you who didn't raise your hands, you see what you're missing out on? If you didn't sign up for a small group and you think you might want to be in one, that is fine. We would love to add you to one of our existing groups. Or you can just go with a friend. Find somebody that you know that you like and just go and join in with their group. If there's nobody here you like, you can come see me and we'll put you in one. But you are invited. We want you to know this. We're extending a special invitation. We want you to know that you're invited to be a part of our small groups. And that thought ought to make you feel special. The fact that you're being invited, right? Invitations are a pretty special thing. I remember one time getting, and I want you to think about a time maybe you got one too, a special invitation, like an invitation that you, it just made an impression on you. Do you remember, can you remember one? I remember one from, it was a time when I was a younger man, and it was a special invitation from a cute little girl in my fourth grade class. And I don't carry the original around with me in my wallet or anything, but I can still tell you exactly what it said, word for word. It was that kind of powerful invitation. The invitation was, "Do you like me? Check yes or no." It was an invitation to be her boyfriend. She was very serious. What a great day that was. I mean, this was a little girl I'd had my eye on for a while. And so it was great, and unfortunately she was sick and never came back to school after that. But anyway, I held on to that for a long time. She really did. She was sick, and I filled it out, and then by the time she got back, I was afraid to give it to her. So it never came to anything. It was really sad. So thank you. Probably worked out for the best. My wife's not here today, but I would still say it worked out for the best. Invitations do that, though. They have a way of changing our days. They can brighten up a sad day. They can change our outlooks, improve our moods. Maybe they even change our lives. Some invitations do have that power. And we get all kinds of different invitations. We get wedding invitations, birthday invitations, anniversary invitations, graduation invitations, all sorts of events and competitions. There are invitations for all sorts of things. And we love to get invitations to some sorts of things. But has this ever happened to you where you got two invitations that conflicted? Two different events maybe taking place in different places at the same time. Maybe you get an invitation to two graduations that are on the same night across sides of town or across the county or in different towns. Or maybe you've got an out-of-town friend's wedding one weekend at the same time as a family member's birthday party. And when that happens, we have to sort of consider and weigh it out. Which one is more important? Which one is bigger? Which one do I need to be at? Which one is going to make the biggest difference? Well, in the book of Isaiah chapter 2, and we're continuing our study of Isaiah along here, we discover a very special invitation, I would say. It is an invitation from God himself. This is a little bit of a spoiler alert there. But as we're going to find out, there is a competing invitation with God's invitation. And we're going to have to consider those and see what's going on here between those two invitations. Well, first, let's look at God's invitation. It comes from Isaiah chapter 2, and we'll begin here at verse 2. Well, this is what Isaiah says. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of mountains. And it will be exalted above the hills and all nations. By the way, when you see the word nations here, and virtually any time you see the word nations in the Old Testament, that's referring to the people who lived around Jerusalem. It's the same word that's sometimes translated Gentiles. Gentiles, nations, same exact Hebrew word. All it means is that it's everybody who's not Jewish. So when it says all the nations will stream to it, it's not talking about like Syria and Iraq, and it's not talking about nations in the sense of nations the way you and I would use the word. It just means all people who are not Jewish. All of everybody is going to be flowing to the mountain of the Lord, okay? Continuing on from there. Many people will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations, and there's nations again. He will judge between the nations and settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Come, descendants of Jacob, let us walk in the light of the Lord. Now, this is a beautiful picture. It's one of my favorite passages, and I have a lot of favorites, but this is one of them. It's a beautiful picture of the ideal for God's people, what is supposed to happen. Israel included is in the depiction of this particular invitation. God says, come, or the people say, come, let's go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He's going to teach us his ways so that we can walk in his paths. That's what the people of the world are saying. We're going to go so that we can learn about this God and so we can live this different kind of life. The point of going to the mountain is to be taught. It's being taught in a specific way of living. It's the purpose of walking, the purpose of life. You're going to find out what it means to really live. That's the purpose for going to the mountain of the Lord. And the picture of this, it says that they're going to flow. And it's the word that's used for water, right? Like a stream. We say a stream would flow. And yet, it's already said that this mountain is going to be the highest mountain. So what you've got here is water flowing uphill. Kind of a supernatural sort of event. In other words, the people that it makes the least sense from, certainly from a Jewish standpoint, which was to whom Isaiah was writing, to the people of Judah, the people aren't supposed to flow, water doesn't flow uphill, and these people aren't supposed to be coming here to learn about this God from us. It makes no sense that they would flow uphill. It's this incredible supernatural magnetism. The law and the teaching and the Torah, they will go forth and they're going to change the world. The word is going to go out of Jerusalem and it's going to change the world. Now this is a different way of thinking for traditional, at least for traditional Israelites. The word of the Lord, the law of the Lord, the Torah was meant for the people of God, right? That's who it's for. It's not for everybody else. Nobody else lives by this. And yet here it's saying that it's going to go out and it's supposed to change the world. You see, the law of the Lord, even though it was written for the people of Israel, it was never meant for them alone. The law, the whole purpose of the law was to change people's lives so much to make them so different than everyone else who was around them, that everyone else who comes through this town, and by the way, it was just so coincidental that the promised land, the place where God placed his people, was this ancient Near East crossroads. Everyone who did any sort of trading in that part of the world had to come through the promised land. God placed them right there, and as these people come and go, they're supposed to see a different way of living, a different way of treating the poor, a different way of treating your wife and your children, a different way of handling the economics, a different way to treat the king, a different way to worship their God. It was supposed to be so different that this word was going to go out because people were going to say, that's the way I want to live. That was the purpose of God's law all along, to change his people to such a degree that the rest of the world would see it. You know, this is talking about bringing about a peace, a disarmament. And rather than saying, we're going to disarm everybody and then God's going to bring his peace, it says, no, God's going to bring his peace first and then disarmament's going to come from that. God's peace results in disarmament. We don't bring about God's peace by making disarmament until people and nations have come to God to learn his ways and to walk in them. Peace is an illusion. There is no such thing as peace. And we certainly would say that's true in the Middle East, right? Peace in the Middle East is an illusion. But really and truly, we're pretty far from the Middle East. And we would say we don't have peace. How many years have we been at war? We managed to keep certain things where we want them to be, but peace? No, we haven't been at peace. This does not mean that the church is just supposed to sit back and sort of wait for the second coming, and then God will bring about peace, then it'll all be better. It's not our job to just sit back and wait. Remember what Jesus said in his Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the peacemakers. We're supposed to be the ones who are bringing peace. And he closes this section right here at the end that with just an invitation for just the Judeans. We got the invitation that kind of goes out from the mountain of the Lord to everybody, and everybody's going to come to it. But then there's one little section here right at the end, one little verse that is just for the people of God. And it says to walk in the light. Come, people of Judah, let us walk in the light of the Lord. And if anybody else, if the rest of the world is ever going to say, come, let's go to the mountain of the Lord, then Judah has to first heed the call, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. If anybody's going to come to the Lord from outside, it's got to be because the people of the Lord are always walking in his light. Does that make sense, church? We may have the exact right doctrine. We may have the best people in Coffee County. The best leadership, the nicest chairs. We may have the best of everything. But if we don't walk in the light of the Lord, nobody wants to hear about our God. Nobody wants to see that side of our lives. So, we have to walk in the light of the Lord. Now, that's the ideal. That's the perfection that God paints. That's the way it's supposed to ultimately end up and will ultimately wind up at the last coming. But that's God's plan and purpose for his people. That is not the reality for God's people, right? I mean, that's what it's supposed to be, but the difference between the way things are supposed to be and the way things are, sometimes that's pretty big. And in this case, it is a really big difference. The contrast between what Israel is destined to be and what she is, in fact, is great, because this is the invitation that they answered. Looking at verse 6, we read, "You, Lord, have abandoned your people, the descendants of Jacob. They are full of superstitions from the east. They practice divination like the Philistines and embrace pagan customs." I want you to notice this word right here, by the way, the word full. I want you to notice how many times that occurs, okay, right? They're full of superstitions from the east. Let's keep going here. "Their land is full of silver and gold, and there's no end to their treasures." That sounds good. "Their land is full of horses, and there's no end to their chariots." That sounds pretty good. "Their land is full of idols they bow down to, the work of their hands, to what their fingers have made." Well, that maybe isn't what we would say is good, but keeping going there. "So the people will be brought low and everyone humbled. Do not forgive them." Not a frequent phrase in Scripture, by the way. Do not forgive them. The people of God, the land of Israel, the land of Judah in this specific case, the southern kingdom, he says, you are full, and yet at the same time, you're empty. You have everything that you need to be great, physically speaking. I mean, go back through the list. She had silver and gold and treasures. She had chariots and horses. By the way, horses are don't think of horses like equestrian events in the Olympics. And these weren't just show ponies. Horses were the ancient Near East equivalent of a tank. They were for war. You didn't just go riding around, or you didn't use horses for farm labor. They were almost exclusively used either by the royal retinue, the people who were carrying the king back and forth, or for war. Okay, this was a sign of great prosperity, not that you just had horses for display, but that you could use them when you fought your battles. So horses and chariots, and they had idols. That's what they're full of. Ironically, in Deuteronomy chapter 17, the people of God, they've clamored to have a king. Remember the children of Israel, they didn't have a king like everybody else at first. And they said, oh, we want to have a king just like the nations around us. And so God said, all right, you want to have a king? This is what sort of king you should have. These are the sort of qualifications you should have. And he warned him, he said, your king should not accumulate, guess what? Your king should not accumulate horses. Your king should not accumulate silver and gold. And your king should not accumulate wives, which, as we know, was the downfall of Israel in that it led Solomon into idolatry. Lots of wives equals lots of idols. So the three things that God prohibits kings from accumulating, horses, silver and gold, and wives, are the three things that the nation's full of. They're full of weapons, they're full of silver and gold, and they're full of idolatry. Israel gets everything they want and nothing they actually need. They have everything that they think they need to be a successful nation and nothing that they need to be the people of God. It seems that Israel has responded to a different invitation. They responded to an invitation that was not God's invitation. Instead, they are full of what they think is important and empty of everything that is actually important. That's the invitation that they answered. And the result that we're going to see is the judgment of God. God says, you want the credit for taking care of yourself? You want to keep yourself all protected? You want to make yourself strong, make yourself wealthy, take care of yourself? You want all the credit for that? You want all the praise for that? This is what your judgment is. It says, the eyes of the arrogant will be humbled, if you keep reading there in Isaiah 2. And human pride brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. For the Lord Almighty has a day in store for all the proud and lofty, for all that is exalted, for they will be humbled. You have everything you need to take care of yourself, and so you're sort of proud of yourself. You remember that day when maybe you moved out and on your own, you're like, I'm a man, or I'm a grown woman. I can put food on the table and keep a roof over my head, and I have a job. Maybe I'm paying my own insurance or whatever it is, and you just feel like, pretty good. Israel had done that with God. They'd gotten too big for God. Didn't really need him anymore, so they moved out, and God says, you're so proud of yourself. Well, I'm going to humble you. See, God has this ideal future planned out for his people, and the only thing that stands between Judah and this ideal future is this pride, this sense that we don't need God. But God loves them enough that he's going to do whatever it takes to get that pride out of them, to get them to the point that they can have their ideal future. I want you to notice just really quickly five contrasts between the world and the people of God. This is the five contrasts that we see in this text. Number one, we see a contrast between the nations, the Gentiles. They seek spiritual benefit, and Judah seeks material wealth. The nations want something of substance, and you've got material wealth. That's what you have to offer. The nations, they come to Zion and world peace breaks out, but Judah is full of weapons. The nations, they seek to know the true God and obey him, but God's people are too busy inventing gods of their own. The nations, all these pagan people, they are granted an audience before God, and God's people are abandoned and denied forgiveness. The nations are drawn to Zion, and God's people are drawn to the world. Isn't that ironic? All these people who are lost and broken and hurting, they're like, we just need this one thing. We just need, where can we go to find it? We're going to go to the mountain of the Lord. Where can we get healing? Where can we get forgiveness? Where can we be brought into a new way of life? They're going to the mountain of the Lord. In the meantime, you got the people over here who should be right on the mountain of the Lord. They're like, oh, that looks good over there. We're going to go back over there. How can the nations be drawn to the mountain of the house of the Lord as long as the people of Judah offer them nothing distinctive to see? My fear, or my great concern for us as a church and for the church as a whole today, is that we face much the same dilemma. Our world hungers for something real, for something substantial. They want real community. They want real transparency. They want real relationships. They want real life. They want a real understanding of their purpose and place in this life. They want a bona fide, real relationship with nature, the creation around them. And in the meantime, you've got the people who are supposed to have this relationship with God, and we're consumed with sports and entertainment and politics and gospel and materialism. That seems to be what's most important to us. We've got the most valuable thing in the world, and we're consumed with the very things the world's trying to get out of. As if somehow, if we only had more weapons, that would make us safe. If we only had more money, that would make us happy and protected. If we only had more entertainment, then I would be content. If only my show were on more than 13 weeks out of the year, right? If only my sports team could have won a game by more than 4 points against the worst team in NCAA football. If only this had happened, or that had happened, if only I had some more of this or a little less of that, then things would be just right. We've got the most important thing, an invitation to the house of the Lord. And this morning we're going to extend an invitation. We're going to be an invitation song like we usually do, but it's really not one invitation. As we've sort of highlighted, there are two invitations on the table today. And I'm not expecting you and everybody with you to come down this aisle. We've only got a few seats up here on the front. But I want you to know that whether you come down this aisle or not, everyone answers one of those today. Everyone's answering one of those invitations. We're either answering the invitation into real community with God, or we're answering the invitation of the world to come out and find safety and peace and happiness on our own. You will answer it whether you're on the front pew or in the middle or in the back, whether you are 80 or 8, whether you are a lifelong Christian or just here for the first time, everyone answers an invitation. The question is not, will you answer the invitation? The question is, which invitation will you answer? And if we can help you in this call to God's invitation, this call to new life, won't you come now as we stand and as we sing?